We'll hear arguments next in H.A. Artists and Associates against Actors Equity. Jeez, we've had good lawyers today. Mr. Brendel, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This is a case which involves the very difficult and complex interplay of our federal antitrust laws, which promote competition, our federal labor laws, which tend to stifle competition, and the labor exemption, which attempts to accommodate these conflicting laws. There's very little dispute over the basic operative facts here. Equity is a union whose 23,000 members include virtually every actor who is allowed to appear on the legitimate stage in the United States. Petitioners are theatrical agents located in New York City. They represent actors who belong to Actors Equity. Although they are independent contractors, the petitioners as agents perform services and in effect work for the actors who are members of Actors Equity. All of the petitioners are regulated and licensed as employment agencies under New York State law. All are members of NATER, the National Association of Talent Representatives, a trade association of theatrical agents located in New York City. TARA is a similar trade association of theatrical agents located in New York City. The members of TARA compete with the members of NATER. Most of the petitioners are very small agencies. They employ no more than two or three agents, and they very rarely represent stars. TARA's members, on the other hand, include such industry giants as William Morris and International Creative Management, each of whom alone employ approximately 200 agents. They represent many, many stars, and they very rarely get a job for one of their clients at a scale or minimum wage. For the last 50 years or so, equity's franchising rules have been in effect. The rules were last revised in October of 1977 pursuant to an agreement between Equity and TARA. Equity and TARA's franchise rules provide that Equity members cannot deal with a non-franchised agent. They provide the maximum commissions which equity agents may charge. They provide the terms and conditions under which agents may charge commissions. Agents may not charge commissions on a scale job, they may not charge commission on a chorus job, and they may not charge commission on rehearsal pay.
I gather then if an agent all year long never got a job for any of his clients above scale, he wouldn't make anything.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that isn't very likely, though, is it?
It isn't very likely because most of the agents will also place actors in non-equity jobs. But there are many petitioners who place a lot of actors in scale jobs. Scale jobs predominate over non-scale jobs.
And so why will agents do that for nothing?
Well, they will do it for nothing because the actors are their clients. They want to accommodate these actors. They hope that maybe someday an actor will become a star. But the basic reason they do it for nothing
and then,
is...
Then he'll be paid a good deal above scale, and he could make up to 10%.
Yeah, if he stays with them. But the basic reason why agents will get actor scale jobs is they don't set out to get an actor scale job. They go to the producer and they say, I have a terrific actor for you. The producer says, I like him, but I'm only going to pay you scale. Well, the agent has now gotten the producer interested. He's going to allow his client, the actor, to have the opportunity to work for scale, even though the agent, in his own self-interest, tried to get the actor above scale. The franchise rules, in addition, provide that all disputes between an actor and agent must be submitted to arbitration. They provide that the union may discipline the agents. This discipline can include fines of up to $5,000, forfeiture of commissions, and revocation of the franchise. In addition, agents must pay...
Do producers ever pay agents?
It's strictly prohibited.
By whom?
by the equities.
By state law or by equity or both?
Well, I believe it's prohibited by equities rules and bylaws. And it's it's prohibited.
That's because it necessarily would follow that if they weren't paying the agent, maybe they would have paid the actor.
Well, I think the basic reason is there's no need for producers to pay agents. The agents are knocking on the producer's door. Equity has collective bargaining agreements with all theatrical producers who employ equity members. Thus, it has collective bargaining agreements with 9 separate groups of producers. It's probably best known for its collective bargaining agreement with the League of New York Theaters, which governs wages and working conditions on Broadway. These agreements are all negotiated by equity and the producers. The agents do not participate in the negotiations for the collective bargaining agreements. An actor is free to negotiate a wage above the minimum set forth in a collective bargaining agreement. But neither the actor, the producer, nor the agent may diminish the minimum or scale wage set forth in an equity collective bargaining agreement. Under equity system, the equity producer directly pays the equity actor. In addition, the equity producer must post a bond guaranteeing payment of scale wages to union members. The primary legal issue before us today is the applicability of the statutory labor exemption to equity's franchising system. If the agents are part of the union's labor group, the statutory exemption is applicable. Under Carroll, independent contractor.
Mr. Brindle, before you get to that, am I correct in thinking the Court of Appeals made no finding as to whether this conduct was a violation of the Antitrust Act?
That
they
is
simply
correct.
Went directly to the labor exemption without determining whether the conduct would be actionable under the antitrust law.
That is correct. Both the Court of Appeals and the District Court reached only one issue, and that was the applicability of the statutory labor exemption. Under Carroll, independent contractors, such as the theatrical agents in this case, are part of a union's labor group if there is present a job or wage competition or some other economic interrelationship affecting a legitimate union interest between the union member and the actor. Prior to this court's decision in Carroll, no court had ever held that a non-union member was part of a labor group unless the non-union member was in a wage or job competition or performed basically the same function as the union member. In Carroll, for the first time, the court held that a non-union member who was not in a wage or job competition could be part of the union's labor group. The non-union members in Carroll.
Can you prevail without our overruling Carroll?
I believe so. It's our position that Carroll is a very unique decision which should be confined to its peculiar facts. In Carroll, the Supreme Court was dealing with the AFM's activities in the unusual one-shot club date music field. The primary purpose of unions is the negotiation of collective bargaining agreements. Nevertheless, in the club date music industry, there are no collective bargaining agreements. To the best of our knowledge, and the unions haven't cited any exceptions, the club date music industry is the only industry where you have unions and no collective bargaining agreements. This is apparently due to the very diverse nature of the club date music employers. These employers are generally hire bands for non-commercial purposes, sporadically, often once in a lifetime. A typical club date employer is the father of the bride who hires a band for his daughter's wedding. It's obviously impossible for the AFM to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement with a group as diverse as fathers of the bride. Because there was no collective bargaining agreement in Carroll, the union, in order to ensure that its musician members got scale wages, unilaterally mandated scale wages. Now, in Carroll, in order to provide that agents would then not book jobs for union members at less than scale, they had to regulate the agents. In Carroll, the club date employers, the fathers of the bride, did not pay the union member musicians directly. This is unlike the situation in equity, where equity producers directly pay equity actors. In Carroll, the club date employers paid the orchestra leaders, who often functioned also as booking agents. Accordingly, if the agents were not regulated by the union, there was no assurance that the agents would pay scale or any other wages over to the union members. The Carroll Court predicated its regulation of agents upon two very specific findings of fact, and I quote them. The booking agent regulations were adopted because of experience that, one, many booking agents charged exorbitant fees to members, and two, booked engagements for musicians at wages which were below union scale. This is from page 113. Here, as I previously noted, it's impossible for a theatrical agent to book a job for an equity member at less than scale because of equity's collective bargaining agreements. Thus, equity has not even attempted to prove that since the advent of collective bargaining agreements, any theatrical agent ever booked a job for any equity member at less than scale.
But if you're right, it would mean that the agent would be free and the actor would be free to let the agent collect, say, 10% of a scale wage as a commission.
That's correct.
And I suppose, and that means that the actor is getting less than scale.
I don't believe
he's netting, so. He's netting less than scale.
Well, he may be, one way of looking at it, he's netting less than scale, but what happens is an equity producer pays an actor. The actor cashes his check. He has disposable income. He can pay his landlord. He can pay his doctor. He can pay his grocer, and he may even pay his agent, but it's coming out of disposable income. Now,
he can't pay him more than 10% anyway, I guess.
Not under New York State law, which governs each and every petitioner in this action. The crux of Carroll, I think, is illustrated by the AFM's licensing agreement in Carroll. The AFM's licensing agreement in Carroll restricted booking agents from booking jobs for union members at less than scale wage. If there was a collective bargaining agreement in Carroll, as we have in equity, that provision and that licensing regulation would be totally useless and unnecessary. With respect to the Carroll finding of fact that agents charged exorbitant commissions, I first note that in Carroll, the AFM permitted the booking agents to charge a commission of 15%. Now, there's no evidence that any theatrical agent ever charged an actor a commission of 15%, nor is there any evidence that a theatrical agent ever charged an actor a commission in excess of 10%. Unlike the situation in Carroll, our agents are all regulated and licensed as employment agencies by New York State law, and as such, they cannot charge more than 10%. I must stress that in Carroll...
They're licensed under the general New York law of the regulating kickbacks by employment agencies?
No, Your Honor, there is a specific law which licenses employment agencies, which has very specific provisions dealing with theatrical employment agencies.
Well, is it a type of law such as that was originally invalidated in the 20s by the case of Rivnick versus
yes,
McBride,
is.
And then later that case being later overruled by the Olson case?
It is precisely that kind of law. In Carroll, again, I must stress that the agency regulations were predicated solely upon the effect that agents had upon the union members' scale wages. Contrary to the union's arguments here, the Carroll Court did not in any way rely on such arguments as agents control access to employment or that it's necessary to regulate agents' commissions to eliminate wage competition between union members. The unions offer three reasons to justify their pervasive and exhaustive regulation of agents. They say agents control access to employment. They say that the prohibition of commissions on scale jobs is necessary to prevent invasion of union negotiated minimums. And they say that the regulation of agents' commissions is necessary somehow to eliminate wage competition among union members. Taken separately or collectively, these reasons do not justify equity's exhaustive regulation of agents. Assuming that it is the agents rather than the producers who control access to employment, and recognizing that agents admittedly have greater access to most employers than do most actors, that circumstance just does not justify the existence of equity's pervasive franchising system because it's not intimately related to wages, hours, or working conditions, which are the subject of numerous collective bargaining agreements. The unions have not cited any case in which it was held that a union is justified in imposing restraints of trade upon independent business persons simply because those business persons have greater access to potential employers than union members. Virtually every employment agency exists in business because that employment agency has greater access to an employer than the applicant does. This is true for employment agencies who place dishwashers, who place corporate executives, who place lawyers. Why should a union member be treated any differently than any applicant who gets a job from an employment agency which is licensed and regulated? Finally, in this connection, I would note it's the unions who control access to the employment of agents. The regulation of agents' commissions is not necessary to prevent wage competition among union members. Now, there was no such argument made by the unions below, and there was no such finding by the district court. Nevertheless, the Court of Appeals here held that the union equity could not eliminate wage competition without regulating agents' commissions. There is absolutely no finding of fact in the record to justify that conclusion. There was no evidence offered that if you struck the franchising system, it would result in actors competing with each other for agent services. And there was no such evidence offered because equity never made that argument.
Well, what if there were proof like that?
If there was proof like that, it might support the Court of Appeals' conclusion that it's necessary to regulate agents.
You mean its conclusion that this is within the exemption?
Yes.
You mean if there was evidence that there was competition among actors in the sense that some actors would offer agents 5%, and others 8%, and others 9%, and others 10%? Is that the kind of competition you're talking about?
Well, I think that's the kind of competition
Suppose there was proof that that would happen absent this system. Would that put this system within the exemption?
I would say no, Your Honor, because the elimination of wage competition.
Well, then you should argue that even if the Court of Appeals was correct, their conclusion doesn't follow.
That is correct, Your Honor, and it doesn't follow because the elimination of wage competition, which is a traditional union labor objective, is the kind of elimination of competition between union members involved in dealing with employers, not union members competing for the services of people such as actors who perform services in turn for the union members. The Court of Appeals did not consider what would happen if the franchising system was struck. I submit that what would happen would be actors would continue to pay agents their traditional 10% commission permitted by New York State law. If, despite the lack of evidence, the actors then wanted to compete for an agent services, they would have to compete by offering the agent a commission in excess of 10%, which is simply not allowable under New York State law.
No, we're offering them 10% when they get paid according to scale.
That's correct.
And isn't it almost inevitable that that would happen, that the agents would begin collecting commissions when their clients are being paid scale?
I don't know if it's inevitable, Your Honor, for this reason. The agents,
that's what you're complaining about. So I see.
Well, the agents are now obtaining scale jobs for union members without any commission whatsoever. So it's reasonable to assume that they might, if the prohibition was struck, they might obtain scale jobs for actors at a commission less than 10%. If they can do it for nothing, it stands to reason that they can do it for something less than 10%.
Don't we have to presume that if you prevail, at least some agents will start collecting some commissions when their clients have worked for scale?
I think that's a fair presumption.
It seems to me it's inevitable. Now, if that happens, it seems to me there's going to be more money flowing into agents' pockets and more competition for these jobs. Isn't that almost inevitable?
Well, I think there will be more money flowing into agents' pockets, but it will simply...
Maybe more agents, too.
It will simply be money that agents have earned.
Well, I'm not saying that's inequitable. I'm not arguing it, but it seems to me you're asking that the market be opened up. That's the theory of your case.
Well, let's turn to a very
practical... Which means you're asking for more competition.
Now, yes. Yes. Well, let's turn to a very practical example. The New York chapter of Screen Actors Guild, SAG. That particular organization permits its members to pay commissions on scale jobs Two agents. Now, SAG has submitted a brief to this court. Nowhere in this brief does SAG contend that its New York actors who pay commissions on scale jobs have as a result not received the minimum wage set forth in SAG's collective bargaining agreements. Nowhere does SAG contend that its members who pay commissions on scale jobs have engaged in a wage competition. Nowhere does SAG contend that its New York members...
They might engage in competition for agent services by offering higher commissions.
They might, but there's no evidence of that in this record.
Does the amicus brief suggest that that actors offer different amounts to agents or not?
That's what it's not only suggested, it states it, but without any record cite.
Because
you are the plaintiff in the case, and presumably, unless you can point to some federal law that the defendants have violated, you ought not to prevail. And even if you win here on the labor exemption argument, the case still would have to go back to find out whether the practices were a violation of the antitrust laws.
That's a possibility. We have asked this.
Let you get to the merits of the
that is correct.
They upheld the affirmative defense of the defendant.
Exactly.
And therefore, the merits you haven't reached,
the merits technically, whether or not the union's franchising agreement is a violation of the Sherman Act, was not decided by either court, although it was fully
argued. Because the courts below held the defendants are exempt from the Sherman
Correct.
Act.
Correct. Let me, if I might, turn for a moment to the franchise fees. There's a deafening silence from the unions with respect to their lack of efforts to justify the imposition of franchise fees upon agents. The only thing said is an incorrect statement by Equity that there was a factual finding in the court below that Equity's franchise fees were cost justified. Now, there's nothing in Equity's bylaws, in its constitution, or in its agreement with TARA, which requires Equity to limit its franchise fees to the cost it incurs in administering the franchise system. Now, apart from this, the issue before this court is not are Equity's franchise fees cost justified. The issue is, should CAROL be extended to permit Equity to extract franchise fees from agents regardless of the amount? The justifications given by the union for regulating agents and agents' commissions do not give any support whatsoever for the extraction of franchise fees from agents. If the union did not collect another dime in franchise fees from agents, this would not interfere with union wage scales. It would not interfere with the union goal of eliminating wage competition. It would not interfere with the union's collective bargaining agreement.
And I take it that if some agent says, I'll live up to all your rules, but the franchise fee, he is then out of business. I mean, he cannot represent Equity's members.
Exactly. I don't believe there's any dispute over that. That's the one of the prices agents must pay.
In which event, your argument for a violation of the antitrust laws would be what?
The argument for the...
Say you win, how would you argue that as a violation of the antitrust
laws? Well, I would say the union has a legal monopoly over the labor market of its union members. But the cases are clear that when you abuse and misuse a legal monopoly, such as here by extracting franchise fees from independent business persons, you've abused and misused your monopoly power. I think that's clear under such cases as United States against Griffiths and the other Ottertail case. It's an improper extension of a legal monopoly
power. So you think you have to go at it on the monopoly side rather than on any conspiracy agreement side?
Well, in addition to that, Your Honor, I think the franchise agreement between Equity and TARA, which mandates that all franchised agents pay franchise fees, is that type of conspiracy or agreement which you're alleging.
Is it part of the agreement between is it part of a franchise? Is it a part of the franchise agreement between Equity and the franchised agents?
Yes.
That they won't deal with others?
Absolutely. And there was a finding of fact by Judge Motley who found, as a matter of fact, that TARA, the franchise agents who are parties to the franchise agreement with Equity, specifically requested Equity to enforce that rule. But in connection
so this
with...
this is an agreement between, you say, between independent businessmen and the union to not to deal with other businessmen.
Yes. There's no dispute over that fact. If you find that agents are part of the non-labor group, then the franchise agreement, which is between Equity and TARA, a group of agents...
Do you see any parallel here at all with the union shop structure? In the labor field generally?
Not really. The union shop structure pertains to a very legitimate traditional union labor objective, that is getting and keeping more jobs for union members. The franchise agreement, which, for example, fixes the prices that and commissions that agents may charge, simply goes totally beyond that. The imposition of franchise fees similarly does.
How much are those fees?
For Equity, the franchise fees, the initial franchise fee is $200, and then the annual franchise fee for an agent is $60, and for a sub-agent, $40.
Well, that's not very much these days, is it?
Well, it's not very much, but for these petitioners, agents, who don't make very much, it seems to be a lot to them. Moreover, there are other unions, such as SAG, which charge thousands of dollars in franchise fees.
Such as what?
Thousands of dollars in franchise.
What union was that?
Screen Actors Guild, SAG. Now, what will happen here...
But they don't... That's a different arrangement, isn't it?
It's basically the same. That's why SAG has submitted an amicus curiae brief, because their arrangement is basically the same to Equity.
But they permit... They allow commissions for scale wages.
The New York chapter, not the Los Angeles chapter. Or the Chicago chapter.
The New York chapter allows commissions on scale...
Right, correct. But not any of the other chapters of SAG. What's going to happen here if the franchising system is illegal? The primary purpose for which Equity exists, to negotiate collective bargaining agreements, will remain unchanged. Equity is free to bargain collectively, and its collective bargaining agreements will not be affected in any way. The business of finding employment for actors, I submit, will continue unchanged, except that agents will now be free to compete with each other and will be free of union domination. In this connection, let me point out that there are personal managers who represent Equity actors. These personal managers charge a commission. That commission is not regulated by Equity, nor are the terms and conditions upon which personal managers represent Equity actors regulated by Actors Equity. Moreover, the personal managers, unlike our theatrical agents, are not regulated by any state law. Nevertheless, Equity continues to exist.
But what do the personal managers do?
The personal managers...
Do they get employment for their clients?
That's a disputed issue. They're not supposed to. They perform other services, such as getting them coaching lessons, teaching them how to dress, holding their hands.
But then they're really not comparable to agents. And this, their principal function is not to find jobs and so forth.
That's theoretically, that is correct.
They're sort of like a teacher or something like that.
They're a teacher, a confidant.
It's like a mother.
It's like a stage mother.
They go out on the road, they handle the money, they dole the money out, right?
Right.
And what they don't ever do is manage. Is that right?
If the franchising system is struck down, the agents will now be able to bargain with Equity as employers do on equal terms. This will replace the present bargaining situation where Equity tells the agents to take it or leave it. Thus, Howard Houseman, who's the chief negotiator for TARA with Equity, Mr. Houseman is himself an agent and a William Morris agent. He testified as to the last negotiations between Equity and TARA, and this is what he said, and I quote, "We all consider that Equity's point of view was indefensible, outrageous, horrible, wrong. simply because they were expecting agents to subsidize the lowest paid actors, somehow to work for them without getting paid. We still feel that way. We accepted a deal under which that was imposed on us. If the court strikes down the franchising system, it will simply mean that equity is no longer free to impose a group boycott upon agents. It's no longer free to fix the prices of agents. It's no longer free to force agents to work for nothing and to do so with immunity by hiding behind a statutory exemption which was designed for totally different purposes. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Lurie, you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Equity is a union of approximately 23,000 members. They work throughout the country, not just in New York State, and they are engaged or seeking employment throughout the country in the legitimate theater. At any one time, the overwhelming majority of Equity members are unemployed. They are constantly seeking employment, and there was a finding in the district court that producers, as a general practice, seek actors through agents, and actors who do not have agents do not have the same access to employment as actors who do have agents. As a consequence of the dependence...
Isn't that true of a lot of employment agency as... Are rather employers seeking employees through employment agencies entirely outside of the actors' field?
It may be that it is true in some instances, and I would suppose that if there were a union in a similar position where the actors could only get jobs through certain specific employment agencies, that the union would have the right to do something about it. For example, a union I know in the restaurant industry in New York signed a collective bargaining agreement with all the employers which said that employees could only be engaged through the New York State Employment Service because they didn't want their members who would be hired for jobs to get to pay employment agency fees. They were protecting, in that case, it seems to me, the minimum wage. Unions in other industries solve this problem by establishing a hiring hall.
And the state of New York has addressed it too, has it not, by limiting the amount of or prohibiting any kickbacks to the employer from the employment agency?
What they have done, if Your Honor please, is limited commissions to 10%. That is not all that we do in this situation. Secondly, even though they have limited commissions to 10%, it would seem to me that that's no reason why the union should not utilize its best efforts to see to it that the actors do not have to pay unreasonable commissions. The fact that the state has legislated doesn't mean that we can't act. The state legislating doesn't make something that would be legal if they had not legislated illegal because they did legislate.
Right. The state legislation doesn't prohibit an employment agency from charging only 5% rather or 0%.
That's right. In addition, if Your Honor, please, these agents operate not just in New York City, although the bulk of them are in New York City and some of them are in Los Angeles, but they operate throughout the country. And there is no evidence in this record which indicates that all states throughout the country where actors perform in a legitimate theater have the same rules and regulations. But we do license or franchise agents throughout the country.
Well, would you say for the purposes of the exemption, which is what we're arguing, that this case is comparable to what it would be if the producers and the union had an agreement which provided that the producers would secure actors only through a union
hiring hall.
You might call it a hiring hall.
Well, Your Honor, please, I think the union would have the right to enter into such an agreement with the producers, but because of the peculiarities of this industry.
I know, but suppose they did.
I think that
would
be
any more suspect than this one or any less?
Sure.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Would it be any more exempt or any less exempt under the antitrust laws?
Than this?
Yes. Wouldn't it be essentially the same?
It would be exempt under the antitrust laws, the hiring.
But no more or no less.
No more or no less.
It would be prohibited in an open shop state.
It probably would be, but that's a question for the labor laws.
Would it be legal if the agreement provided that the costs of operating the hiring hall be paid by the employers?
Well, I think that the National Labor Relations Board has often ruled in this matter that if the employers contribute toward the hiring hall an amount which relates, or, for example, an employee, those hiring halls have to be without discrimination, and any individual theoretically can walk in and be sent out, and he can be charged a fee commensurate with the cost of operating his share of the hiring hall.
Well, is the $200 initiation fee and the $60 annual fee, in your view, somewhat comparable to that?
Well, if Your Honor, please, absolutely. I mean, the circuit court in this case, the Court of Appeals in this case, found that although there was no evidence in the record as to the cost of the operation, that there was one full-time employee and other people involved, and that as $12,000 was the total that was paid by the agents, that it clearly was commensurate with the cost of the operation.
Mr. Lurie, would your theory make it appropriate for a union to franchise acting teachers?
No, it would not, Your Honor, if Your Honor please. I had that question come up the other day in a different way. There are a group of casting agents in New York who cast for various theaters, like the Public Theater and other theaters, which are constantly casting. And those casting agents have been giving courses. They are teaching courses on how to audition. And there has been a tremendous uproar in equity because the equity members say in order to get jobs in the theaters where these people cast, you have to take the course of the casting agent. And the question came up, did we have a right to do anything about that? And I said to the union very explicitly, we do not have a right to. We can tell our members you may not go to those courses if you don't want to, and we will possibly discipline you for going to those courses, but you have no right to take any action against the casting director.
Would you say disciplining your members meant imposition of a fine?
Well, I would say disciplining our members means anything which is permissible and reasonable under the internal, in accordance with the Constitution of the Union.
And under our Boeing decision, which leaves the substantiality of the fine to the state courts.
Yes, I would say we could fine. We might have some problem in expulsion. There are various, but I'm really not prepared to discuss that aspect at this moment. But I think we could take any usual, normal union disciplinary action. We could fine them, and indeed in this case, in the case of Barr, it is quite clear that when we were having a dispute with the agents about the rules that we were going to promulgate, we informed our members, and by the way, there is a finding in this case by the district court, not disturbed by the Court of Appeals, that there is no combination between this union and the producers in an effort to enforce this system. There is also a finding in the district court that there is no conspiracy between Tara and the union. And by the way, if I may say to the court,
the agents who are franchised don't insist that the union not deal with other agents?
The agency agreement does say.
Yes, so there is an agreement, whether you call it a conspiracy or not,
well, if Your Honor,
that they won't deal with other agents who won't pay the franchise fee.
There is an agreement, if Your Honor please, but let me say, number one, that there is no evidence in this case that anybody or any agent who is prepared to meet and conform with the regulations cannot be licensed.
What would you think it would be different for purposes of the exemption if it were otherwise, that the union simply made an agreement with a group of agents not to deal with anybody else, even if they were willing to live up to all the rules?
Well, let me say that
yes,
I would think that would change the situation. I don't think that situation would ever or could ever come about, because it is the interest of equity to have as many agents as possible and have as many members represented by agents.
But
But
that can't that isn't be true. This case. Because if that were true, you'd allow commissions on scale.
Well, if Your Honor, please.
Because isn't it inevitably true that when you don't allow that to happen, there are fewer agents?
Well, I suppose that it,
so it is not
possible.
In your
there is
to
certainly no evidence.
The number of agents.
If Your Honor, please, there is no evidence in this case that I know of that any agent has ever been denied access because has not come into the agency business because of that, or that any agent has ever dropped out because of that.
Well, but isn't it simple economics, as I suggested to your learned opponent, that if you cut off one major source of income into the industry, namely commissions on people who work at scale, and lots of people work at scale, don't they?
Well, if
there'll
Your Honor,
less money available to pay agents, and there obviously there'll be fewer agents.
If Your Honor, please, I think it is. It's not in the record, but I think it's clear in the theatrical industry that people work for scale actors not because they want to. Indeed, there is no obligation on the part of any agent to take any actor on as a client. They work for a scale actor because they figure that if they catch Al Pacino when he's doing The Indian Wants the Bronx off Broadway, that several years later, Al Pacino is going to be making $1 million a picture and they're going to get 10% of that. The fact of the matter is that although there may be some correlation between what you've postulated, and I would say that logic probably supports it, there is no evidence to that effect, and further, that most of these agents do not work just in the theater. A lot of agents work in the theater, as he indicated, in the motion picture business, and in the various in connection with the radio and television.
I just was questioning your argument that you're desiring to increase competition. I thought your argument is that you have a perfect legal right to suppress competition because you're surely doing it.
Well, Your Honor, please, I didn't say we didn't have a right to do this. I said really what I was saying is that it is in the interest of equity, and they do a balancing, just as this court does often, between the problem of regulating the agents and protecting their members and protecting them from abuses. You know, there was a lot of talk before that there were no abuses. Well, these regulations have been in effect since 1928. But the history of what happened prior to 1928 is replete with abuses. In the Edelstein case in the Second Circuit, there were affidavits which indicated all sorts of problems, including excessive commissions and so on. And what petitioner is arguing is that because these
Wasn't that partly because this court had then held that New York State couldn't regulate the employment agencies or agents?
Well, if Your Honor, please, first, what happened was that equity, in an effort to avoid the abuses which were so prevalent, lobbied for the passage of the New York State law. When it was passed, they were finding that it was not being effectively enforced. They found, for example, that under the New York State law, it was quite easy for somebody, an agent, to say, well, when you sign with us, you've got to give us a bonus. And if you get a job, we would like you to give us a Christmas present. And this was, in the record, the joint appendix here, you will see an excerpt from the Revolt of the Actors, which does state just that. It is also true that having found that under this court's decision the Jersey law was not going to be enforced and everybody thought it would apply to the New York law, then equity really went to town and set up these regulations. But there were abuses before the regulations, and there are and to condemn or say something is not necessary because it succeeded in its objective just doesn't make any sense.
I just ask one more question. This question, what's an exorbitant commission? I guess in the view of the union, any time an actor gets nets less than scale, because he pays a commission, he pays an exorbitant commission.
If Your Honor, please, there are two. Correct.
I was saying the thing.
Our position is that we have negotiated this contract and this scale for the actor. For example, traditionally in the business, chorus kids, the chorus actors, never have commissioned an agent because there isn't anything an agent can do for them. They can't find access to jobs for them, and they can't get them any more than the minimum in the collective bargaining agreement. That's it.
We think that anything which invades the minimum that we struggle to fight for and that we've gotten for them is excessive. We also think anything in excess of the regulations are excessive. And we feel that if we are within the statutory exemption, that we have a right to set these rules.
Mr. Lurie, before you sit down, this is a matter of personal curiosity. How old a union is Equity?
Equity was formed around the turn of the century. It's about, I think it was 1914, around, that's not the turn of the century, around 1914 there were a group called the White Rats who organized the union. They were a bunch of actors who, actors had been terribly depressed. I mean, without a union, the strange thing about this profession is that they beg you for the right to work for nothing. And one of the big struggles Equity has with its members is to say, you may not do this. They are so desperate to work, they are performers and they want to be seen.
Even
they,
Sarah Bernhardt had problems?
I'm afraid I'm not that old.
Has it always had the name Equity?
Actors Equity Association, I think so. They were originally called the White Rats, and that was the group that organized Equity.
Mr. Gold.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, all that Mr. Lurie has expressed indicates why all of us on the union side of this issue believe that this case is controlled by Carroll. The court in that instance addressed itself to the use of booking agents in the by musicians and the situation faced by all of the theatrical unions is roughly the same. It is a situation in which work is intermittent, in which there are many more competitors for jobs than there are jobs, and where the traditional pattern is that there is an intermediary between the purchaser of labor and those people who are offering themselves for employment.
Mr. Gold,
what about the fact in Carroll that the orchestra leaders there actually played as musicians with the dance bands? Do you regard that as a distinction of no significance?
It, for the purpose here, we think it is irrelevant because Carroll concerned many issues, and one issue was the extent to which you could, to which the union could regulate the orchestra leaders. Another issue was the extent to which you could regulate booking agents, and that booking agents question was dealt with separately. Indeed, we think this, the question here is somewhat easier because all of the individuals who are in competition for these jobs are true employees. The question is whether when you have this two-step process of getting a job, first to get an agent and then to get the employment, the union is limited to only dealing with the person offering the job or can regulate that intermediary stage. And we believe that if the union can only sign the collective agreement and get scale in this setup where there is a two-step process, it can't do its job.
Well,
because
Mr. Bell, what about the emphasis that your Brother Brindell puts on the collective bargaining agreement between the producers and Equity? We had nothing like that, of course, in Carroll.
That point is treated in the brief of the union, and the record in the Carroll case shows that there were collective agreements in the steady engagement field in Carroll, and that was covered by the musicians' booking agents' rules, just as the rest of the engagements were covered.
And Carroll made no distinction.
And Carroll made absolutely no distinction. This was a point that was at issue in this case. We believe that every one of the efforts that the petitioners make to distinguish Carroll fail.
What about the fee?
Well, my view on the fee is that if the rest of the system were in any way suspect, that might not stand. But if we are correct that the whole point and purpose of the system is employee protective, we certainly believe that the fee, which barely covers the cost of the system, would be
lawful. Should be paid for by the...
In part.
By the agents?
Let me... you raised a question, either you, Mr. Justice White, or Mr. Justice Rehnquist.
Well, I mean, that certainly wasn't covered by Carol.
No, I would agree entirely. But the question was raised as to whether, in a hiring hall situation, the employer pays. The norm is that the employer pays.
When you say if this system were suspect, the presence of the fee might render it...
Your Honor, I didn't mean to say that. What I meant to say was if the system were otherwise no good, and I was trying to defend the charging of a fee for a system which was otherwise not in the labor exemption, I don't think I could succeed on that point standing alone. But I do argue to you that if the whole point and purpose of the system is proper under Carroll and within the labor exemption, I don't believe that the fact that the cost of the system is shared by the union and the employer invalidates the system or even invalidates that one provision, any more than I believe that a perfectly lawful hiring hall could possibly be invalidated under the longstanding practice that it's the employer who pays the cost of the hall, either in whole or in part. Because if it isn't the employer who pays, or it isn't the agents who pay in this instance, then it's the members who pay. And that ought to be a subject, if you're in the labor market area, which is settled by the back and forth between the varying groups and their economic, depending on their economic strength, and not by the law.
Mr. Gould, I'm just curious. Here we are dealing with, in the labor, at least the we're dealing with jobs. Suppose the union and its members simply announced that that none of the members of this union will deal with any attorneys who charge more than X dollars an hour. We just won't. We'll deal with anybody who will, but we just won't deal with anybody who won't, who charge any more, or doctors. They have to, we'll deal with them if they have a satisfactory scale. Now, that may not violate the antitrust laws, but would it be within the labor exemption?
I'm not positive where the line is, but I can indicate what we think the theory is and what we understand the basic point of the labor exemption to be. Seems to us that the basic point of the labor exemption is that there are two differing systems that Congress has decreed. One is the antitrust system, which regulates product markets and business markets in general. The other is a system where employees are permitted to combine to protect themselves against job and wage competition
in
the labor market.
And in my example, that's not the labor market.
And I was going, it would seem to me that we're certainly stretching the concept of the employee's labor market to its very end.
May not violate the antitrust laws, but
That's correct. But in this instance, what we rely on very heavily is that we're in the heart and soul of these employees' job market. The findings are that the agent stands between the employee and the job. He is the means. In that situation, we believe that no matter how you cut this, whether you do it under the statutory exemption or you do it under the non-statutory exemption, that the union is regulating a matter of immediate and direct concern.
Actually, neither are expressed statutory exemptions either. They are referred to in the terminology of the
we think they're all express. Congress has been at this for some time. There's Section 6, there's Section...
One is no more expressed than the other.
No, they are... I guess I would put that affirmatively, that they are equally, but plainly, as Mr. Justice Frankfurter said in Hutchison, and as Mr. Justice Powell said in Connell, the basic task here is harmonizing these two different systems, reading these series of laws together in a way that makes sense. And the basic point that we think has emerged from all of that jurisprudence is that if the union is regulating a matter of direct and immediate concern in its employees' job market, that is within the labor exemption, obviously.
Would you say the same access was limited here, if only a selected group of agents were franchised?
That depends on the test you apply to determine what the meaning of the labor exemption is. It's not absolutely plain that the labor exemption permits unions to do absolutely anything.
I agree with you, but now suppose the agents what's their organization?
TARA.
They have an agreement with Equity, and only TARA members can deal.
I think we would have to show that the union was operating to advance a direct and immediate interest. I don't know how, on the facts you give,
how
we would possibly show it. The point, though, is that if we are operating to advance a direct and immediate interest, it appears to us that the fact that there is an effect on a business market, it cannot be sufficient to invalidate our system, because if that's true, then there's nothing left of Congress's determination of the labor, that the labor market can be regulated in this way. There'll always be an effect. Jewel T.
Before you sit down, you touched upon this distinction between focusing on the labor market and on the other hand, on the product market. Has this court ever, in so many words up to this point, made that distinction in focus?
Yes, I can think of at least two occasions on which it's been made, one of which was alluded to from the bench. Mr. Justice White's opinion in Jewel T has been the theme on which I've been addressing variations.
Yes, does his opinion really make that distinction? He said even in the product market it's still all right, and within the exemption if it's the least restrictive possibility, as I read it.
I read his opinion to say if the issue is of direct and immediate union concern, and there the direct and immediate union labor market concern was the desire of those employees not to work at night, the fact that there is also an effect on the product market is not sufficient. And then the contrast is if you regulate the product market directly with the hope that you will get some benefit eventually, and the example would be that given in Pennington, where the union hoped to regulate the product market in terms of who would enter and who would not in the hope that eventually it could get higher wages. The example I just gave is an instance, and Alan Bradley would be another, where the union is outside the labor exemption. We believe the test for determining when it's inside the labor exemption is basically that I just articulated, that the fact that there's a consequential effect or an effect on the product market is not enough to defeat the exemption.
I made this observation because I think there's some recent academic commentary to this effect that seems to be emerging.
I think that some of the academic commentary doesn't do the opinions justice necessarily. Connell, I was going to say that Mr. Justice Powell's opinion for the court in that case notes that the center of the labor exemption is where the union is attempting to regulate in order to prevent wage and job competition among its members in its labor. market. And we think that that's the point. After all, the exemption.
The question, I guess, then, is whether the agents are in the, in which market are the agents placed?
Well, you're going to have an effect. We make an argument, it's point two of our amicus brief, that in, an agent, because he deals in the services of employees, doesn't really have a product market in the classic sense. But as Jewel T shows, you can regulate in the labor market, and that has an effect on the product market as well. They intersect, and we think the exemption does, our labor exemption does not require that we show that there's no effect on the product market. Because if we had to show that, we'd really have to defend ourselves on the merits against the antitrust claim. After all, no effect on the product market. There's no restraint on trade. We think what it's sufficient, given these two schemes, if we show we're staying in our basic area and there are only consequences. Thank you very much.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Brendel?
Yes, sir.
You have 1 minute left.
Okay. Very briefly, in connection with Mr. Lurie's statement that there was no...
You better get over to the microphone here.
In connection with Mr. Lurie's statement that there was no evidence in the record that he was aware of that agents are leaving the field or are reluctant to enter it, let me quote from page 196 of the Joint Appendix, which is a letter from the president of TARA to Equity. TARA's president said this, "Many of our members, that is the agents, doubt whether they can long continue in the field. Without naming names, we all know that many fine and trusted agents have deserted the ranks, either going into other fields such as personal management or moving to the West Coast. Many of those who function now in the field of equity get their living from other sources such as commercials, other motion pictures, deals, and so forth. Other agents have had to give up their independence and merge with bigger offices. But even the big and powerful agencies find it now unprofitable to handle work in the theater, especially the representation of the average income-earning equity member." Thank you.
Do you think, could I ask you one? Do you think all decisions to move from New York to the West Coast are motivated by actors' equity practices?
No, I don't.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...